on PRN.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, don't yeah. you know we're going to have a Solartopia.
We are here in Solartopia once again for another hour. And this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman with Steve Rosenfeld. And soon to be joined by Bob Fetrakis. We're going to talk about election.
I'm here.
Stuff.
All right.
Bob Fetrakis?
Yes.
Bob, you on?
I'm on.
All right, great. All right, you guys are both on. So listen, Steve Rosenfeld and Bob Fetrakis, the three of us have been together dealing with election protection issues for since 2004, and we're running into another election coming up. If Donald Trump gets away with a national emergency, maybe he'll just call the whole thing off. What do you think, guys? What's the possibility? Give me an odds. Give me odds. What are the odds that Donald Trump is going to A, try, and B, succeed in calling off the 2020 election? Bob Fetrakis, what do you think? You've been down in El Salvador where they do that kind of stuff.
I'm thinking, well, I didn't know Mussolini. Is that I knew a few people that did, and Trump's no Mussolini.
Right.
So I think as much as he'd like to call off the election, much as he's posturing, not going to happen.
Right. Steve Rosenfeld, you want to give us some odds on...
I basically agree with Bob. I think there'll be a lot of posturing. You see it now, actually. You see it now. Like, I'm not going to have any of the debates hosted on the national networks. Oh, this big bill that's coming through Congress, through the Democratic-controlled House, it's all about stealing everything. When actually their side is the one that's done all the stealing, in most cases. So the rhetoric will be there, but I don't see how they can stop it.
Well, this is as a historian, I would have to say that this is the first presidential election in American history where the incumbent has had a serious personal interest in getting reelected. As a method of staying out of jail.
Yeah.
Nixon couldn't have run anyway. No president in history really has had the direct incentive of trying to stay in the White House to stay out of prison. This is really the first time. And of course, we don't know what's going to happen over the next a year and a half or so, but it is very clearly a calculation on Donald Trump's part. I mean, his guy, Paul Manafort, is about to go to jail for the rest of his life. I don't know what Trump's pardoning capabilities for Paul Manafort would be. Bob is a lawyer. I mean, can he pardon Manafort and keep him out of prison?
For federal crimes. But the length and breadth of Manafort's crimes, I think they're so voluminous that he could pardon a lot, but I don't think he's going to capture them all, and some of these are going to fall into other jurisdictions.
Right. Well, there is now the dynamic, especially with his kids, Trump's kids, of the fact that he won't be able to pardon them for crimes in the states, particularly the state of New York, which seems hot to trot. To get these kids, at least the boys, indicted on something. This is a really rare situation. And Donald Trump really can't not run for reelection. He has to do this, and he has to win. I mean, this is going to be one motivated dude. So let's jump right into it. Steve, let's start with the primaries. You know, there will be primaries, and, you know, it's a remarkable reversal. In 2016, it was the Republicans that had this horde of eminently forgettable candidates, and then the one emerges, and then the Democrats, it was really just, there were three, and the third was, I actually liked him, this guy from Maryland. What was his name? Do we remember the guy who ran for Maryland in the primaries? And then Mike something.
Yeah, the tip of my tongue. Yeah, O'Malley.
Mike O'Malley, yeah, right? And I liked him. He was good. He was pretty liberal. But he completely disappeared. It's amazing. I mean, I bet 90% even of the political junkies that you would ask who was the third guy in the Democratic primaries in 2016 wouldn't remember. As far as I'm concerned, the nomination was pretty clearly stolen on the Democratic side. And even lacking that, if Hillary had the humility and good sense to run with Bernie, we wouldn't have Donald Trump in the White House. I don't think you get much disagreement on that. Do both you guys agree with me on that? Do you think if she had nominated Bernie, she would have won by too many votes to have the election stolen?
I think she would have.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the bubble that burst on her was, number one, neocon foreign policy and neoliberal free trade policies, much of it attributed to her husband. Bernie would have been the exact opposite on both of those issues and thus balanced the ticket and excited people, particularly young millennials. So I think it would have been a victory had she run him as VP.
Yeah, I mean, her rallies and her persona, she was just deadly. It was unclear why she was running, except it was her term. And she was an absolutely horrendous candidate, never went to Wisconsin. I've read this.
Well, I thought it was her turn in 2008.
Yeah, somehow she missed it. And, of course, you know, I've always asked my classes, Is the United States more racist or sexist? And I think 2008 proved it's actually more sexist. That was, you know, Shirley Chisholm had a great line about that. The first black woman to seriously run for president, the congresswoman from Brooklyn. She was really a great person, Shirley Chisholm. And she was asked where did she get more abuse on the campaign trail, from being black or from being a woman, and she immediately said it wasn't even close, and that people were far more abusive about her being a woman than being black. And so, you know, Obama did beat Hillary, and there were all sorts of other reasons about that. But now we're coming up, Steve Rosenfeld, on a new primary season, and like the Republicans in 2016, the Democrats in 2020 are going to have a herd of candidates. Now, I just read moments ago in the New York Times that Sherrod Brown has announced he's not going to run.
Right, right. And Michael Bloomberg has announced he's not running. A bunch of them are not running now.
Right. And I was disappointed. Although I got to say something about Sherrod Brown. I think he's making a wise decision not to run in personal terms. I can't imagine anything more punishing than running for president of the United States, especially in a crowded field. But I still would not rule him out. I mean, if you have a crowded convention and no clear front runner, Sherrod Brown would be the perfect dark horse.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I was at the DNC winter meeting about 2 weeks ago, and state party chairs we're talking about it being a contested convention, not being decided before the first vote. Now, some people say that's crazy. You know, the process will knock out three quarters of these people by the time it comes around to South Carolina. But we'll see. That's what they were saying. I wasn't saying it, but we'll see.
Well, you know, with that, Bob Petraeus, do you remember what other candidate, non-candidate from Ohio was nominated and won the presidency, after a completely gridlocked convention? He was a Republican. You guys want to jump in? It's a trick question. He did become president. I'll give you a hint. He freed Eugene V. Debs. You know, Warren G. Harding was not a serious candidate for president in 1920, and they got to a convention, and nobody was a clear winner, and there all of a sudden you had Warren G. Harding. Pretty amazing. So I'm gonna say right now that I would give a share. The fact that he's not running actually could enhance the possibility that he would become the Democratic nominee. Because if you go into a gridlock convention, he would be the perfect dark horse. He really would. Anyway, let's get now to the mechanisms here. Steve Rosenfeld, you've done a lot of serious investigation on the process. I guess you were just at an important convention. What does it look like? What does the process look like now for choosing the Democratic nominee?
Well, it really falls, and the process for choosing the nominee falls into two different categories of events. And what they are is, you know, there are primary elections and there are caucuses, and they're not the same. If it's a primary, it's an election run by a local government election agency, and all the government rules apply, and the government systems are used, you know, the registration systems and the, you know, whatever the voting machinery is and everything like that that you see in November. But if it's a caucus, and some states have a combination of the two, but there are a handful of states, starting with Iowa, and then most importantly, the fourth event, Nevada, where the state party will basically rent a voting system from a private vendor and use it to figure out, you know, who is their nominee or the winner to what usually is a series of conventions, the next round or level. So it's local caucuses to county to statewide and all. But the big wrinkle in 2020 is that the Democratic National Committee has said that they want to have more participation in their caucuses or the states that have caucuses. And they are leaving it up to the states to figure out how to do that, but they issued these delegate selection rules in December that mention it can either be telephone voting or online voting. So what I've been doing is trying to figure out, you know, what has that looked like when there have been other party-run elections using online or telephone systems, and it's fascinating, actually, because there is a history. And by the way, most of the Democrats that I spoke to at the national, you know, at the DNC, were unaware of this history.
God. Well, so the process would be in a state with what states would have it?
Okay, well, let's talk about Iowa. We'll talk about Iowa and Nevada, okay? So Iowa right now has, you know, until in 2016, they had something like 1,669 or 67, I forget, precincts on the caucus night where people, you know, this is the old cliche, they go out on a cold winter night for several hours, and they huddle in these rooms, and what they actually have is a series of votes where basically if your candidate gets less than 15%, then you're out. And they keep doing that until they have a clear winner, or there's no more votes left, and you know, somebody is down below the 50% threshold. Now, 50% of what is the key question there? Because it is not a popular vote contest. It's 50% of the delegate allocation to the next stage, which is county level conventions. So that's where in 2016, Bernie and Hillary basically were virtually tied. But anyway, so what they're trying to do for 2020 is they want to have an off-site or remote participation option for not just the caucus night, which is February 3rd, but on 5 days beforehand, or five, you know, like these windows of several hours apiece on those five, it's like early voting. So I've talked to the state party director, and they're in the process of talking to different vendors of different voting systems. And the State Party officials have mostly been talking about having telephone-based voting. Now, there's almost nobody in American elections has used this. It's used in private sector elections. It's used in government elections, Canada. And, you know, their thoughts are, well, the old folks, they don't know how to use the Internet, and then we got to get them to participate from home, so we'll get them to punch the buttons on their telephones. I can tell you how that has gone, well or not, and in some cases not, in Canada. But there's also the notion that they might have to have an online platform or option for younger people because they don't even know what a push-button phone is. I mean, they sort of do, but you know what I mean. They use you know, their iPhones and their tablets and everything for everything. So what that ballot is likely to look like on caucus night on these.
Hello, Bob.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, there's some background noise.
So I'll just say one more thing, and then I'll turn it over to you guys. What that ballot, Harvey, is likely to look like for that remote voting is some version of a ranked choice system. And it will have. And we can talk about how this is going to work, but I can tell you that in many cases that I've looked at where other parties, Republicans, have tried doing this, a whole bunch of things have gone wrong. And we can talk about those a little later.
Yeah, well, let's do that. I mean, telephone voting? I mean, what do you call up and you say, hi, I'm Sluggo,
what they do in Canada, and the problem, and they're trying to phase this out there, is you literally go through a series of prompts. But if you have 20 candidates...
Jeez.
What happens is, you know, you're given a code to get in and access, you know, the system. But sometimes if you get cut off before you finish or you mess up or you hit the wrong thing, you can't get back in. Or sometimes you just give the phone to someone and say, hey, I can't do this. You figure it out. This is literally what's happened in Canada.
Bob, have you followed this at all? Are you familiar with how the Democrats are planning to run their nominating campaign? Bob Petraeus? Hello, Bob?
Oh, maybe we lost him.
Maybe we lost him. Maybe he'll call back. Yeah, well, Steve, this is terrifying.
Well, it's astounding, actually.
Can you?
It's astounding because what you have is this is very typical in the election world. You have people who are in political office who don't know what it takes around the mechanics of running elections. And you know, in general, it takes a while for the public to learn any new system. And you usually start with low-profile elections. That's why they do the online voting and the telephone voting in Canada with municipal elections and not their federal elections. And they're trying to build up trust over a number of years. And what happens is, so the Democrats are thinking about starting at the absolute top, the absolute pinnacle, with literally no trial. Where's the trial run for the Iowa caucuses? There is none. And
it's mind-boggling. Well, tell us, you followed the primaries in 2016 pretty closely.
Yeah,
I could never figure out how did these caucuses actually work.
They
open up a room and you showed ID and you walked in.
I'll tell you how they work. They from state to state. In Iowa, it's almost like an old style town meeting where people gather in a location and they group themselves in groups in you know, different corners or different sides of the room around the candidate of their choice, and then they vote in a series of rounds, and whoever gets less than 15% as a candidate, basically those people get to realign and regroup with others. And they keep doing this until nobody has less than 15%, and those are your results. Now then you get, so you have these results, you know, X percent based on the numbers in the room. Well, what does that really translate to? Depending on your location, because this is weighted, and you know, rural areas get a little more clout than urban areas because they don't want to be underrepresented. This is really kind of, it's like a proportional representation type system. You are allocated a certain number of delegate equivalents to the next stage in the process. Well, I think, I forget the exact number, but I mean, you know, out of 20,000 delegate equivalents to the next stage in the process, Hillary got 5 or 6 more than Bernie. And therefore, she ran away with the headline. And they never gave out the raw numbers in Iowa. And, you know, and basically the party which was pro-Hillary let her grab the headline and get on the plane to New Hampshire, if you will. And now, Nevada was slightly different. What you have there is the same kind of thing, except they had some special precincts during the day at these Las Vegas casinos. And those were, and you know, Las Vegas, which is Clark County, is where, you know, the majority of, you know, hangs in that state. So the state party there, and this is, these are the conditions that led to this great animosity between the Clinton campaign and the Sanders campaign. The state party there did not put any caucus sites in Las Vegas on any college campuses. And that was intentional. That was not the case in northern Nevada around Reno, where, lo and behold, a lot of campuses, Bernie won. Las Vegas, you know, Clark County, there were none. But in the special casino caucus sites, what ended up happening was, and I witnessed this. This was not, I'm not making this up. I saw this literally. What happened was Bill Clinton and some of the top campaign surrogates went through the employee lounges at a half dozen of these different sites, and they rounded up people, and they said, hey, you want to come vote? You want to come vote? Come on, you get time off from work. You're allowed to do this. Come on, let's go vote. And what ended up happening was at the very last minute, they basically stormed the registration desk and poured into these rooms, and all of a sudden there was 1.5 times the number of people that were there. Whether or not they were registered Nevada voters was irrelevant. A bunch of them probably weren't. I was told by lawyers there are people here who weren't, but there was nothing they could do about it. And and that was partly how Hillary Clinton won Nevada. Now, the Sanders campaign made a bunch of really dumb mistakes there too, which I don't necessarily need to repeat. They got to the state late. I mean, the day before the caucuses, they kept everybody outside of Las Vegas waiting for 4 hours the night before in an amphitheater for Bernie to show up, and people were completely discouraged by the thousands instead of being encouraged to go home and turn out other people. So there's, you know, it's not totally black and white here, but that's what the caucuses are like. And you know, people yell, people scream, people bully, and it's not precise, and that's where all the criticism comes in, that it's not a professional enough process, you know, reflecting the stakes. And what are the stakes? The stakes are a presidential nominee. So those are the caucuses. So what they want to do is they want to add an online voting or telephone voting component to it. And that's what I've been reporting on.
In what state? Bob, are you with us, Bob Patricus?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Well, I'm finding this fascinating. Bob, what's going to happen in Ohio? How are they going to choose the Democratic nominee in Ohio? Are they going to open up an amphitheater at Ohio State and
have
people come off the
primary state? The problems last time, you saw, and I wrote about this, and you wrote some articles with me, is that a lot of the Bernie supporters were, of course, millennials, college kids, college age, 20-something. And a lot of the stuff we saw in 2004 with, you know, the 305,000 voters purged in a presidential year, which is against practice and precedent in Ohio, that happens in the odd years like 2003. That was what was happening, particularly in the college campuses. I was at OU, Ohio University in Athens, and all sorts of, you know, a young, freshly scrubbed Bernie-crats showed up at the polls, and their names weren't there, or they were challenged and turned away. The same thing in Bowling Green and Kent. It was interesting because on the campus at OU, the students that actually lived in the dorms, a dean had written them a letter, you know, on the school stationery, which meant that they had established residency. But a lot of them were thrown off, you know, arguing residency questions about where they really lived. But the tactic we saw was that was Karl Rove in 2004. So essentially the Clinton forces successfully used tactics that had previously been used by the Republican Party. But again, you know, Ohio.
Do you think they read our books and used our books as kind of guide?
Yeah, the how-to, yeah. I think Rosenfeld made it into a how-to manual.
Right.
I think we ought to reissue it. How to rig an election? You know,
right.
Because we've got stuff
we
in there. The Rove Force, the Mighty Texas Strike Force, going to nursing homes in Cleveland and picking up absentee ballots, and they never make it down to the Board of Election.
Well, what we should do is have Roger Stone write the introduction. Well, so what's going to happen in Ohio in 2020? What's the process going to be in Ohio? And then, Steve, I'll ask you about other states. How are the Democrats going to choose their nominee in Ohio 2020?
Well, I suspect the battle going on right now is they're trying to find somebody that can beat Bernie, right? And the great dream is Joe Biden, you know, the only other guy.
Oh, God.
Really consistently in double digits. And they're not about, you know, running favorite sons. I remember they were in a similar situation with, you know, trying to fend off Jerry Brown in 1992. And out of nowhere, suddenly, everyone agreed on, another candidate. Bill Clinton emerges as the comeback kid. In 2004, the same thing. I mean, nobody's that, you know, it's a primary state, and they have, and you show up, and also it has sort of where you pledge to be, support, and you run as a delegate. And in 2004, I mean, nobody was in Kerry's room. And then suddenly, within a few weeks, you know, Kerry's the front runner. So it really depends on whether they can force people out of this race early on and, create a front runner to beat back Bernie, which is really the goal. The regulars here in Ohio, the regular Democrats, you know, it's anybody but Bernie.
Well, that was the case with Dennis Kucinich. Anybody but Kucinich, and they wound up with Mike DeWine in the state house. So you got a regular primary election in Ohio. Steve, what are the states in 2020 in the Democratic side that are going to be caucus states that are going to be a complete mess?
Well, we don't know if it'll be a complete mess, but we know that they're headed into. We know that they're going to be trying stuff that's never been tried before, and they're going to be doing it in super high-stakes circumstances. And no matter whose fault it is, including the voters, you know, the whole process will get blamed and be smirched. So it starts with Iowa. Iowa's the first. And they're the ones, to my knowledge, so far that have issued the most detailed plans about the most details now seeking plans on how to accomplish it. So they're going to have 5 days of early telephone or online voting, and they're going to have an online voting or telephone voting on caucus night, plus the actual caucuses themselves. And all the online and offsite participation is going to be limited to 10% of the delegates that are allocated that night to the next stage in the process. The next one, it's a pretty big deal. It's the first Western primary. Western state, and it's Nevada. It's the fourth or fifth one. I always get confused here. And it's important because it's very different demographics than anything, you know, on the East. It's a state that's, you know, it's almost majority non-white. It's very working class. And then what happens is you've got some smaller states. You've got Maine, and somewhere down the line you have Hawaii, which doesn't matter that much. And somewhere down, and then you have some states that have what they call a split system, where they have a combination of caucusing and and primaries, and that's Washington State and also Texas, but that's the very last one. And I'm probably forgetting one right now, but that's what. But mostly the big ones are Iowa and Nevada to think about, because those are going to be when you still have a big fields, and it's not going to be a done deal.
And what you have in those two states, as I understand what you're saying, is the potential for total chaos. I mean, you've got the caucuses, which are.
I mean, this is Bob. I don't know if you've heard any of this or read any of these pieces I've written, but this is actually funny if it wasn't so serious. Okay, so the first example I like to cite is in 2016, the Utah Republican Party had online voting for a percentage of their overall presidential caucus. So you know how the Republicans are completely obsessed with voter ID, right?
Yeah.
They used Eventbrite, the app Eventbrite, to do their party registration at the urging of the Republican National Committee. And guess what? 40,000 people signed up and 10,000 people couldn't get in on the caucus night.
And, couldn't get into the computer.
They couldn't get through the registration process to even get, an online ballot.
And were they segregated by race or gender? I mean,
what actually happened was a lot of people who weren't registered Republicans decided they wanted to participate. And because they were using an online event app, I mean, Eventbrite is used for conferences. It's not designed to be synced up with voter registration databases. They had people who were not registered voters, and the system basically got clogged up. It didn't know what to do with them.
God, is this the United States of America?
This is 20. Okay, let me give you more examples, because these are funny, except they're serious. So then, in 2018. Utah Republicans tried a different vendor, one that uses smartphones as ballot marking devices. This is a company called Votes, and they're based in they do some pretty interesting stuff these days. But the thing then was, Votes did not anticipate that people would not download their app until the last minute. So what happened was, they have security controls around, the Google store, the Android store and the Apple store. So they thought all of a sudden that there was some kind of giant, massive swarming or hacking attack. I mean, the term is a distributed denial of service attack. Basically, because people didn't download their app until the last minute. Then they went to download the app and they couldn't get it. Then the Utah Republicans thought the Russians were hacking their... I'm not making this up. I mean, this is the way people think around this stuff. And then what happened was, those that could get in, now this is really interesting. You know, the votes online voting app has very strict voter identification protocols. They're much stricter than the Democrats bemoan voter ID. Well, this is way, way tougher to what they do is, they want you to first upload your driver's license or a state-issued voter ID with a photo. Then they want you to take a video selfie where you move, and then their software matches the image on the photo ID with the image on the video selfie. Then you get a ballot, then it goes into a blockchain, and then you have to, after you do all that, you have to submit either a fingerprint or another video selfie at the end. So people couldn't even, those who got the app couldn't even finish or do the authentication process, and they had to revert to paper.
What states are we talking about here?
That was Utah 2018. That was Utah 2018.
Oh, God. Well, of course, we know all those Mormons. I mean, I can't even. Bob, are you able to download an app? If you were a Mormon living in Utah, do you think you'd be able to vote?
Well, ever since the old order Amish raced to the polls in 2004 for the first time in history in Knox County, and gave an unprecedented vote for Bush, even though no one saw him racing to the whip in the horses in the buggies. I don't know.
See,
you know, downloading an app. I mean, does it make any sense? I mean, they've tried voting on phones and by phones before. Complete disaster in a Canadian municipal election. They had to do the election over.
Oh, let me tell you about that. They didn't have to do one election over. They had to do 50 municipal. So what happened last October in Ontario was Dominion, which does elections in the States. It's a Canadian company, but I think it's, you know, now it's a Canadian-American company. So they were doing online voting in 50 municipalities. This is last October. And what happened was, whoever put in the order with their telecom company to enlarge their bandwidth missed typing in a zero. So by a magnitude of, you know, adding, you know, one, you know, added a decimal to the exponential, you know, one, whatever the right mathematical term is, because it lacked one zero, they had pipes, digital pipes that were that much skinnier, and they couldn't process the online voting, so they had to declare an emergency, an election emergency in 50 municipalities, and extend the voting period by 24 hours. This is 50 municipalities. You can look this up. This is Ontario. The most amazing story I found, which is the most recent one I have, was how, this is astounding to me, was how, you know, we've all heard about how those absentee ballots were stolen in North Carolina. Bob, you talked about it, you know, the Karl Rove squad going into those old age homes and grabbing and stuffing absentee ballots. I wrote about how people did the same thing with online voting in a party-run election in the province of Alberta in 2017. And basically, and my sources for this was one parliament member who went to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and filed a complaint, and the Alberta's and a former the former vice premier of, you know, the province, like the lieutenant governor. These are my sources on the record. And what these people did was, because it's a party run election, they are not going to their government voter registration databases. And of course they have those lists of people, but what they did was they went to these community centers of new immigrants, basically people from South Asia who are in Alberta, and, you know, Sikhs and Hindus and things like that, and they basically said, oh, you're new citizens, you have to join our party and fill out this form so you can participate. And when they grabbed all those forms, and people signed up and they put in their driver's licenses and all the official stuff, the campaign operatives grabbed them and swapped in different emails. So when the party's vendor, who I think was Dominion, sent out the emails with the login codes to vote in the leadership election, they went to one of the candidates' back offices and those people voted those ballots. And when people complained to the party running it, they were accused of being loudmouth, sore losers, you know, anti, you know, all the garbage you hear all the time. Lo and behold, the guy who played dirty won.
Wow, what a surprise.
So this is before you even get to the counting.
Oh my God! You know, I'm speechless. I mean, I sat in 2004, after the 2004 or 2005, and I typed up and we put out the list of the things that we knew that J. Kenneth Blackwell had done in Ohio in 2004, and it was, I mean, I had to get up and throw stuff. It was just outrageous what they did. And this is just, you know, it just gets better or worse, however you want to put it, you know. I mean, Bob, are you seeing stuff like this coming up in 2020?
And did we in Ohio, you know, you leave it up to the counties on what equipment to buy. So you're allowed to buy DREs, right? You're allowed to buy the no paper trail, push and pray, faith-based voting systems, you know, where private proprietary business interest does all your programming for you on the software or the firmware on the machine. So, I mean, I don't know why they don't require actual paper trails. And to the credit, they'll actually allow you to vote on paper, vote on a machine that has a ballot you mark, or vote on a DRE, you know, all voting in the same election in the same county. So, you know, why? And again, remember what Kerry said in that radio interview back in September, on September 6, 2018, when he, you know, lamented the fact that the machines were hackable and you shouldn't allow proprietary, you know, private, partisan, proprietary companies to, you know, program your software and computers.
Well, let's see. The election was stolen in 2004, so 14 years later, John Kerry comes out. Is that the first direct comment that we've had from John Kerry?
I was on the phone with Cliff Arnebeck and Jesse Jackson, one of the first things he tells us is that there's no correlation in with the exit polls in New Mexico and the actual vote totals. So, I mean, he knew right after the election when we were talking to him in 04, he knew there was a problem. And again, so did other people. You had John Marshall, who was working for General Wesley Clark and doing field operations because Clark was still interested in running for president perhaps next time around. And, you know, they're all coming up with the same conclusion, you know, and then later we find out in King Lincoln Brunsville, you know, that there was a back door built into the architectural map of the computer tabulations system, and they've been outsourced to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where a God-fearing born-again Christian minister, Jeff Averbeck, you know, counted the votes and sent them back to Ohio with a last-minute sudden shift that makes no plausible sense. So Kerry knew. I mean, Kerry knew. He just didn't go public for whatever reason.
Well, here's the question then, Steve, and we're all going to ask this question. What's going to happen when Donald Trump runs against, you know, Democrat A and Vice President Democrat B in 2020? Do we have to write off Ohio and other states because they're going to be pre-rigged? I mean, what are we looking at here in 2020? Let's get beyond the primaries. Is the presidential race in 2020 hackable?
Of course it is. I mean, you've still got private proprietary companies secretly programming the central tabulators, the machines. Now, you've got a better situation in some cases because some of the counties have the ballot imaging. But remember, under Ohio law, you don't have to turn your security system on. You know, I've sued them twice on this, you know. The judges are saying, you know, don't bring this up again. But you've got a state-of-the-art security system on these, you know, digital ballot imaging system. And the Ohio court said, well, it's up to the boards of election whether or not they want to turn on their auditing functions and security functions. So, of course, it's hackable. If, you know, just like your house will be robbed if you've got a state-of-the-art system with all these cameras and motion detectors and breaking glass, and you turn it off. Why?
God. Steve Rosenfeld?
Well, I come at it in a slightly different way. I think that there were some big differences between now and 2004. most states in 2004 were just delighted to have these paperless systems where there was no possibility of auditing anything, and that you know as Bob just described, it's the conditions for the perfect election crime because there's no evidence. You just have, you know, it's like, we're telling you what it is, believe us, go away. And you know, and that literally was what the process was, whether it was in court or audits or, I mean, that's what happened, you know, in a zillion different, you know, variations. In 2020, more states are going to have these ink marked paper ballots that are then scanned. But the problem that it's a little harder to forge that. The problem that I see is that. And by the way, I blame progressives for this, not necessarily the right-wingers. The problem that I see, and I'll explain why I say that, with very few exceptions, most states will not be able to independently verify the accuracy of the vote count before the results are certified. Now, what I mean by that is, you know, the technology now exists for you to have an initial tabulation on election night or election day or in early voting and have an entirely independent second system run through the underlying paper or ballot record and compare the results and see. Now, there'll be some small variations, like maybe one or two votes off because of scanners and stuff, but if there are really big differences, and which will tell you that something really is wrong, and then you got to actually look at the paper. That can be done, but the problem is that a lot of states are they're pretending that possibility doesn't exist, and I'm embarrassed to say, or disappointed rather, that a lot of liberal election advocacy groups have completely, they don't want to discuss this possibility. Instead, they want to talk about what they call post-election audits. They want to use a statistical random sampling called a risk-limiting audit, which is basically dumbing down the definition of an accounting. And it's when you're basically postponing the accuracy check, and it's not even a good accuracy check, when it doesn't matter. When you can't go to court, when you can't have, instead of having a better, fuller accounting, you know, prior to even filing for a recount. And this is what drives me personally. So who are these people? This is the Brennan Center. This is Verified Voting, who should change their name to Estimated Voting, because they're not verifying the votes. They're estimating them after the fact when it doesn't matter, when it's purely an academic exercise.
How many states is this prevalent in?
Well, it's prevalent in a lot of states. And the problem with this is where it comes from. So the only states where it's not prevalent that I am aware of is Florida might pass legislation to allow the use of ballot image audits pre-certification, which would be a tremendous step forward to actually not having that state's, you know, results completely, you know, stolen. It would make it, stealing them, infinitely harder, because you would have a layered and sophisticated evidence trail you would have to really figure out how to hijack. And Maryland, the state of Maryland, also has this. But I'm telling you that, you know, most other states don't even want to talk about a pre-certification audit. You know, they don't want to even admit that it's a possibility. And the thing about this that drives me completely nuts, and I'll get off the soapbox in a second, is you have all these conferences, you know, week after week, month after month, about cybersecurity this and cybersecurity that, and, you know, we are preventing the hacking of this and the hacking of that, and our tools are so damn sophisticated to prevent all this electronic meddling. And yet, on the other hand, nobody says, hey, we can apply some of these same sophisticated tools that involve the best of analog and digital technology to actually verify the vote count before things are certified so people can actually trust the results. It's like the elephant in the living room. Nobody talks about it. Instead, they're talking about the safe zone. Oh, post-election audits. We can do a random sampling, and it will be an efficient process, and we'll use advanced mathematics. But you know what? In close elections, that doesn't give you anything, because if you have elections like Florida had, where you had 3, you know, 8 or 10 million votes, three elections with less than, you know, one half of 1%, and two of them less than one half of a quarter percent, less than one quarter of 1%. You need to recount. You need all those ballots. You just can't pull out random ballots and think you're going to say, "Oh, now have confidence in the results." So it's complete insanity to me. And I don't know. And I know where this comes from. You know, the people who are oppose all these. You know, after Ohio, were mathematicians, statisticians who said we got to have a better way to audit stuff. Let's use statistical process. But this statistical process, the math, doesn't work when things are super super close. And by doing all this random sampling, you destroy the possibility of looking at an inventory of the paper. You know, they could have done this in Florida, Harvey. They could have done this in Broward County. They had the technology. It wasn't certified by the state. Instead of waiting for 5 days to figure out were there really 30,000 presidential undervotes, they could have run the software and in 20 minutes figured out not only were there 30,000 undervotes, they could have given you ballot images for people to look at, and then instead of everyone behaving like banshees on the outside, you know, the pro-Trump this and, you know, and everything like that, you actually could have looked at evidence, but they didn't do it. So this is the stuff that drives me completely nuts, because when you say 2020, you know, the big issue, Trump's going to say, the other side stole it. He's going to say it a million different ways, you know, unless he doesn't. And so what's the proof? And all this money, millions, are being put into cybersecurity, but nothing is being put into verifying the actual counts with evidence that people
unbelievable
believe. You know, so that's
we're talking here. We're almost out of time. We're talking with Steve Rosenfeld and Bob Fitrakis, two of the leading election experts in the world, and certainly with massive impact here in the United States. And we're gonna run out of time in a minute, Bob. Are you gonna? I mean, so basically, Bob, what you're saying about Ohio is that they have the technology, they have the hardware to do it, and they don't want to turn it on. And Steve is,
well, you need an actual Secretary of State that's going to send directives out and rationalize the system. There's already some problems when you leave, you know, you give away $100 million and you leave it up to the counties to pick, you know, the machines. I mean, the machines should have all had paper. The machines should have all been transparent. And also at the county level, there should be standard county central tabulators. I mean, the systems themselves are these incredible sort of cobbled together different types of machines, different vendors, many of them, again, partisan. I mean, the people who do a lot of the maintenance on the machines and the voting records in Ohio are the Rapp family, which is one of the leading right-to-life families in the state of Ohio. I mean, essentially, between Michael Connell in 2004 and the Rapp family and Triad, the election in Ohio was privately contracted to the right-to-life movement in the state.
Well, is that going to be the case in 2020? And Steve, Bob, and then Steve, do you see this happening in other states?
Well, you know, you don't know it. You got to look and you got to pull every contract, and then see what in the hell's happening. The problem is these private partisan companies shouldn't be getting a contract.
Yeah, well, Bob is right.
Steve, are you seeing this? Are you seeing this elsewhere?
Potentially, yes. I mean, I some states, unfortunately, some states matter more than others when it comes to, you know, presidential elections and the Electoral College. So states that should be swing states, like Georgia, are going to have a new voting system. And the question is, you know, and it's not looking like they're making the most pro-democratic choices for that. You know, Pennsylvania's going to have a new systems. The question, you know, it's there are Democrats in charge, but I mean, Pennsylvania Democrats fought the hardest against a presidential recount in 2016. They were more vicious and effective at shutting it down than the Republicans, who stopped it in Michigan and slowed it in Wisconsin. You know, Florida might have some transparency if these laws pass, and that's only because the county clerks there were so beat up after 2000 that they don't want to get embarrassed again. You know, other swing states, you know, Virginia, I don't know. You know, I think Ohio is, most people just write it off as being a red state, like Missouri. it's hard to say. Wisconsin used to have good, you know, fairly good transparent elections, but Scott Walker basically gutted that whole, you know, truly, it had the best truly partisan, nonpartisan, rather, oversight system in the country. It was run by a bipartisan panel of retired judges.
Uh-oh. Oh, God. So we'll have to do this again. You guys are great. Steve Rosenfeld and Bob Patrickis and Harvey Largo Wasserman. We're going to return to this many times. Thank you, crew in New York. We'll see you next week in a electronically elected Solartopia.
Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a